I would like to start off by saying it is so good to see so many familiar faces in the crowd today. That's right. It's not my fault you all look the same. That's why you're all familiar. So I've made to understand there will be tears later on, so I will attempt to be the laughter. So then you have the laughter and the tears. It's a good combination. So first things first, you will notice that I have zero slides. I have no PowerPoint presentation. I didn't make anything for this. It's not rehearsed. But that is not something that I did out of laziness. That is actually a thing that I chose when I first started doing talks like this. I made a conscious decision to do that. And I did that because everything that you're going to hear from me comes from real experience. It comes from the heart. And that's 100% true. Like I could probably have made a presentation. I probably could have thrown some numbers in there and, you know, dazzled you with, you know, factoids or something. But that's not the kind of connection that I want to make. I want to make a true, you know, human connection that transcends all, you know, that kind of thing. So that's what I'm going for. So to start off with, I want to discuss how I got into gaming. Some of you will have heard this before. Some of you in this audience have heard me speak before. So a lot of this, well, not a lot of it, but some of it's going to be leftover content, but there will be some new stuff that's really cool in there too. This story is very popular every time I tell it, so I'm going to tell it again. All right, so I got started in gaming because of a prank. Because my older brother is a terrible human being. Or at least was a terrible human being at the time. So when I was very young, when I was a young boy, I actually dismissed video games outright because they had the word video in them. Well, that must mean blind people can't do it. Video means pictures. You know, that was it. That was the entire my kid self philosophy on video games. That's it. And so one day, my wonderful brother says, "Hey, would you like to play Super Mario Brothers on our Nintendo Entertainment System?" He didn't say it like that. It was just, I'm embellishing. So I said, "Yes, of course. Why not?" Because I didn't expect anything. You know, I didn't expect to succeed, so I just kind of gave in just to see what would happen. So we go to the room where the Nintendo is contained, and he hands me a controller. And we begin the game, and I begin pressing buttons, and all of a sudden, before you know it, I am collecting coins, extra lives, slaying monsters, saving princesses. Well, only one princess. The others are all fakes. Spoiler alert. And then the game ends. The entire game is over. And apparently I won. So it didn't take very... I mean, I was ecstatic. I believe, if I recall correctly, I was jumping around in excitement because I'd done this amazing thing that I didn't think I could do. Which is, of course, when my brother dropped the bombshell, which was that he had handed me the unplugged second player controller. And my button presses did literally nothing while he completed the entire game. He told me this right away. He had to ruin my fun. And at the time, I remember that I was crushed by this because I went from a state of believing that I couldn't play video games at all to a complete state of acceptance that I could not, apparently I could play everything, and then back to the original state. And so I remember being utterly crushed by this. But apparently it sparked something because I made a mental vow to eventually beat one game by myself. Without his help, without anyone's help. And this didn't actually happen until years later. I did mess around with games before that, discovering that I can, in fact, get through the first level of Super Mario Brothers by myself with enough patience. But it didn't actually happen until the Super Nintendo came along. And it's actually interesting because all you wonderful Microsoft people will be happy to know that the first game that I beat was on my own, was the Super Nintendo version of Killer Instinct. I promptly, as soon as I defeated the final boss of Killer Instinct, ran out to my very unappreciative of video games mother and, you know, yelled and screamed and, you know, because I was so happy about it, that she needed to come look. Keep in mind, she had not been watching me play the game. So when she came in, she was watching the credits. That way, she didn't really get it. Like, oh, that's cool. What's that? You know, I couldn't really tell her what it was because I didn't really know. But the fact is, I know what I had just done, even if she did not understand. So, you know, that was the kickoff, really. And I've been a gamer ever since then. I've been playing games for my entire life, basically, since then. And it has led to the work I'm doing today. It's led to here, you know, and other things. And it's an amazing thing. But to continue, so that's how I started with gaming. But what I want to express here is two main themes for this crowd. The first of which is that game accessibility for the totally blind is probably not as scary as you think it is. That's something that I've touched on before in other talks. Another thing is that we, as blind people, we blind gamers, we may not be many, but we genuinely want to play, you know, every game. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, that's the passion. You know, we are passionate about games. And to start with, to continue with, I guess, I want to talk about the thing that I call accidental accessibility. And that is one of the ways that I kind of approach the whole idea that accessible gaming or creations of accessible games for the blind is not as scary as you might think. Because there are games that are not designed to be accessible that just are accessible. Maybe not completely. Maybe there are limitations to that accessibility, but there are games that exist that on some level we can play and complete in some cases on our own with maybe some workarounds here or there. But, you know, it's kind of proof that game accessibility does not necessarily have to be as difficult as you might think. The first of those examples that I'd like to give is a classic example that I've been giving for a while, a lot of my talks lately. Resident Evil 6 is a game that not a lot of people liked, all things considered. I mean, it's a Resident Evil game without survival horror elements, so it was not very popular among critics. But you'll find that it's very popular among blind people because we can play it. You may be wondering how that is possible. Well, it is possible because of some kind of interesting design choices that the development team of Resident Evil 6 made. And I know you can tell that they didn't make these design choices for blind people. They just made them, you know, if you kind of look at the way they work, I feel like they were just kind of made for ease of use, not necessarily for the blind. It just happened to work that way. So in Resident Evil 6, you have a button that brings up your PDA. And basically that PDA is your map. It shows you where you are, where your next objective is, and you know, how to get there with an arrow that points how to get there. Well, how is that accessible to blind people? It's not in that sense. However, when you press that map button to bring up that map, that PDA, the camera points in the direction of your next objective. And the movement in Resident Evil 6 is based on which direction the camera is pointing. If you combine those things together, all we have to do to get to our next objective is hold that map button down and walk. And because the camera shifts to point to your objective, we will automatically walk towards the next objective. That is huge. And the developers probably don't even realize it. It was an accident, and that's the whole thing, accidental accessibility. Another thing that helps is they have a feature that allows you to do what they call it a quick shot. But what it really is it's an auto-aimed shot that takes a little bit of your meter, I think they call it your stun meter, to use, because you'll be stunned if you use it too much, your tiredness gauge. It takes one bar of that to use it, but it essentially auto-aims at your nearest target. That's very helpful. The sound design is also very helpful because even if we can't use that quick shot, the sound design is so good in Resident Evil 6, even if you don't like the game, sound design's good. It's so good that we can use surround sound to actually orient on an enemy. It's that good. Some other things that helped, there are quick time events in the game, and there's a mode that Resident Evil 6 has that it's honestly kind of an easy mode, and I'll get to that later.
They patched in that you could use that mode for all difficulties.
Really? Because I didn't know that. All right. I didn't think there was anything about Resident Evil 6 that I didn't know. Thanks for that. All right, so that happened. Anyway. No, but it's basically a mode that allows some of the QuickTime events to be done automatically. The weird thing about this mode is that it does not, and I can confirm this for a fact at least, it does not cover all of them, just some of them. Some of the more movement-based ones. Like there's certain moments in like helicopters where you have to wiggle the thumbsticks and you know get the helicopter out of a situation, blah 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 blah. Those are done automatically for you. But moments where the only thing you have to do is press square at the right time are not always done for you. But it's a little weird. But it's still helpful. It's still you know on the right path, even if it wasn't intended to be for that reason. One thing I always do when I talk about Resident Evil 6, though, is there's a joke that I have to make every time. So because the map feature was not intended as a blind accessibility feature, it has a quirk to it. I think the intention of this is that when you are looking down at your PDA, because the character is looking at a PDA when they're looking at their map, so when you're looking down at a PDA, maybe you're not walking as fast or running as fast. You do it in moments of quiet. You see, this is a feature we blind people use all the time. So when you press the map button, you can't move as quickly as you could when you're not pressing it. You can only move at a walking pace. So I always make a joke where someone is calling desperately for help. You know, one of your companions in the game, "The zombies are coming! The zombies are coming! Hurry up!" And you're like, "Okay, I'm on my way. Wait, hang on. Where are you?" I'm on my way. Just hold up." So it's funny because that's one of the things that tells you right there, you know, it wasn't intended to be played that way. But because we can play it that way, we do it. That kind of covers Resident Evil 6, but now I want to talk about this is new content, folks. And this one is actually thanks to my fiance. This would not have happened if it weren't for her. Diablo 3, the console version of Diablo 3, is basically through a series of accidents playable by blind people, even the totally blind. And this is big. Like this is a huge one. This took a while for even to realize, number one, but secondly to really get started with it. Because there's a lot of elements to it. And it's little things. It's a bunch of really tiny things. Like when you move, if you run into an object that you can't move past or a wall or something like that, you'll stop moving. And that sounds like such a simple thing, because obviously we as humans would stop moving when you run into an object we can't move past. But many games, and I've learned this from all my, you know, just messing around and trying to play games, many games keep the walk animation going even when you run into something. Apparently it looks really weird, I don't know. But many games do it. And that actually is a hindrance to blind gamers. Because when we're trying to, we may not get a full picture of what the map looks like, but when we're trying to find our way to somewhere, when we're trying to, you know, get somewhere in a game, the fact that we stop moving means, okay, we need to turn. Or we need to, you know, change our trajectory in some way. So You know, that when a game actually implements the whole "I'm running into a wall, maybe I should stop walking," maybe when that actually happens, that's a huge help. That's actually a good first step on the road to accessibility. So it does that. And secondly, when you are fighting monsters in that game, as long as you're close enough to them, it will automatically target them. And even if you're not close to them, if you're using a ranged character, all you have to do is face in their direction, and then it will know that you're targeting that monster in that direction. And once again, the sound design is good enough that we can orient on the positions of monsters and even our companions. A lot of times when we were starting with Diablo 3, I was playing with my fiance as a companion, and I would just orient on her and what she was doing. And, you know, if I followed the sounds of her, you know, attacking monsters and everything, I could find where we were going, and I could get there as well, and much more quickly even. Because sometimes she would make... So basically what we would do is she would be walking somewhere, but she would just keep swinging her weapon just so there would be an easy-to-orient-on sound. And I would follow it. And through that method, I actually was able to get much quicker to the places we had to go to. So sound design, good use of stereo and surround sound, really important as well. So the next thing that helped out with this is kind of another sound design implement. Different items that dropped made different sounds, and different qualities of items that dropped made different sounds. If a legendary item dropped, you always knew it because it makes this very specific sound that means, hey, I'm awesome. You should probably pick me up. I mean, I'm just saying. And those sounds, when those items dropped, they dropped at their actual positions in the stereo or surround sound field. So if I heard one of those sounds behind me and to my left, that's where the item was, and I could easily go back and pick it up. There's so many little things. Let's see. Oh yes, when you're playing story mode in Diablo 3, the console version, the waypoint area, which allows you to teleport to the next area, allows you to teleport all around the map. While you're playing story mode, the waypoint will automatically highlight the area you're supposed to go to. That's perfect. We don't need to worry about where it is on the map because it's automatically telling us where we're supposed to go. All we need to do is use it when we think we need to go somewhere else, and it'll just teleport us there. There are sounds for quests being updated, quests being completed, and you know it's just there's a lot of little things. I'm not going to go into probably all of them, but there's a lot of little things. And through all of those things and the use of what's called OCR, which is optical character recognition, we're able to play the game almost entirely on our own. Optical character recognition, for those who don't know, is the pulling of text from an image. And there are pieces of software that allow us to do that now. What I currently use, so I currently have Diablo for the PS4. Sorry, guys. And yes, it's also available on Xbox One. Yes, I just don't have it there yet. Anyway, right. So what I use currently is the PlayStation 4's Remote Play app, which is not intended for accessibility, but allows you to transmit the video and audio from your PlayStation 4 to your computer, or into your PlayStation Vita, but I'm using it on the computer in this case. And what I do is I use a screen reader called NVDA, which has a tremendous text recognition ability, an OCR capability. I believe it actually uses Microsoft's API for that, if I recall correctly. Yes, haha. I was right about something. So I use that in combination with the Remote Play app. And using that, I can read a bunch of things on screen. I can use it to equip gear, new gear onto my character. If I pick up a legendary, I can go identify it, and I can read what it is, and I can potentially equip it if it's better than what I have. It's not perfect by any means, and doing this takes a while. Sometimes when I do a scan, it won't properly read the stats. So I'll have to rescan and rescan. Sometimes I have to rescan several times. It's not perfect. It's not a real answer. It's kind of a Band-Aid. But the thing is, that's that's where we are. That's what we're willing to do. That's the level of patience we blind gamers have because we want to play games so much. And I'll get to that a little bit later too. There's a very specific thing I'm going to talk about later that is going to really show you what I mean by that. But yeah, so that's in combination with all of those things. I'm not only playing Diablo 3. I have for those who may know about Diablo 3. If you know anything about Diablo 3, you'll know what this means. I have a almost level 600 Paragon barbarian character. That is mine. Is currently running the Charge Barb build, which is one of the most powerful builds for barbarians that exists in the game right now. Yeah, the research on gear I did on my own. Once I started playing Diablo 3, I just began absorbing the knowledge that I needed to make my character awesome. I learned about builds. I learned about what the best builds were for different situations. I learned how to build them. I've helped other people now build their builds of characters. And I have made their characters better. And I almost regret it in some cases. I killed all of you. That's right. One trip to the PvP arena was all they needed. And then they backed off. I had this wonderful ability called Firewalk, which literally left fire everywhere I went. So all I would do is walk around and laugh as they walked into fire and died. So great. That's a gaming story for you right there. So that's my examples of, that kind of covers my examples of accidental accessibility. There are others. Fighting games, by their very nature, are kind of accidentally accessible, even if there's no additions made to them. Fighting games are the easiest genre to break into if you're blind, mostly because most fighting games are played on a 2D environment. Even if the graphics appear to be 3D, you really play them on a 2D level. You're always right across from your opponent. You always know where they are. So there's no question about being able to find your opponent. That question is taken care of. It's just gone. And so every move you do is going to be done towards your opponent, no matter where you are. Now, we still have to pay attention to what side we're on and how far away we are from our opponent, which is covered in modern fighting games by proper stereo panning. There I go again, talking about stereo sound again. It's very important, it's very helpful. But that in itself, that's all we need to play a fighting game effectively. Other than that, it's just the same things everyone else already learns. Once we learn what the sounds are, each character in modern fighting games usually has their own voice and their own sound effects for attacks and things like that. Once we learn those things, it's the same thing as anyone else. We learn the buttons, we learn the combos, and then we can play fighting games as effectively as anyone else. There's plenty of examples, and I mean literally hours of examples, on my YouTube channel of fighting game shenanigans. So I'll get to shout outs on my YouTube channel later. And I have business cards. So fighting games are the most easily accessible genre right off the bat because of those things. And to kind of segue there, I actually wanted to talk about Killer Instinct, which is, again, the first game I ever beat. But the Microsoft re-release of Killer Instinct on Xbox One is utterly tremendous in a lot of ways. I know I'm not the only blind person that plays Killer Instinct. I actually have friends who play it. And I know that one of them, I believe, was here last year talking about Killer Instinct, which is great. And he may have said something similar to this, I'm not sure, but here is my thoughts on Killer Instinct. Killer Instinct is about 90% accessible. Here's why I say it's about 90% accessible. One of the things I wanted to kind of go back to over and over again is my thoughts for what we need in terms of being blind and being able to play a video game. I have thought about this, and I've finally broken it down into one single thing that you need to consider if you're trying to make a game accessible to blind people. And I think this applies to other disabilities too, not all of them. I think it applies to blind people across all the spectrum of blindness, from color blindness to total blindness. And I think it also probably applies to deaf gamers as well. And I think here's how you can break it down. What we need is information. And when you're making game accessible, what you need to consider is what information we are lacking and then how we can get that information. So going back to Killer Instinct, the reason I say it's about 90% accessible is because it has, number one, a complex menu structure. It is not a simplistic menu structure. I wish it was. It's not. Number two, it has an entire mode called the Shadow Lords mode, which is based around creating a team of fighters and going through a series of challenges which have story events attached to them as well, little story events that trigger at certain points that are text, where you have to make a choice. Entirely text. Currently, we don't have that information. That detracts from the accessibility of the game. The fact that we have basically an entire mode that we cannot effectively play on our own. We could probably mash a few buttons and struggle our way through the fights. I mean, the fights are the easy part. It's all the management aspect, which is intriguing, and I would love to try it on my own, but it's just not practical because the information isn't there. And that's kind of the theme. If we could move Killer Instinct from 90% to 100% accessible in one shot, and Brandon already touched on this, but what I'm referring to here is the narrator APIs that now exist. If the developers of Killer Instinct used those APIs and connected narrator to their game and had narrator read the menus and had narrator read those little encounters that happen in text only, that'd be it. All of a sudden, the doors flung open. We could play that Lords of the Shadow Lords mode. We could navigate the menus in general. And we could play every character's tutorial on our own. Every character has an in-depth training mode in Killer Instinct, which is great that those exist, but it's all text. If we had access to that information, that immediately jumps the game from 90% to 100% accessible. Done. Because, like I said, fighting games are the easiest genre to break into in terms of accessibility. So that's all we need. So that brings me to my next portion of my little talk here, where I wanted to provide some of the things that I think of all the time. Every time I can't play a game, I try to come up with what that game would need to become accessible. So I'm going to go through a couple of different examples. One of them is a kind of a simpler one, and one of them is a very complex one. And because I think that's essential, it's essential to know that I think that some game types would be easier to make accessible to blind people than other game types. The first one is take any game from Telltale, very popular developer, narrative-based games. A lot of people would call them point-and-click adventure games. Almost any of their games, I could make those accessible in no time if I had the ability, the power to do that. So in a lot of their games, what you're doing is you're interacting with objects and people, starting conversations, and doing those things is what moves the story forward. It would be remarkably easy, in my opinion, to make that game accessible because currently in those games you walk around and select the objects with a cursor. Well, my idea is to every room in the game, you present the player with a menu that's browsable. And that menu is, of course, read aloud to the blind player. You browse the menu. It contains all of the objects and people in the room. Now, if an object or person is not meant to be seen by the player yet, then that would be hidden in the menu as well. You wouldn't be able to interact with it early or anything like that. We wouldn't cheat the game. So it contains all the currently interactable things. When you select that object, well, there you go. It automatically moves to it and interacts with it. I know this is technically possible because if you have, in all the Telltale games, if you have the cursor in the right position, even if your character is far away from an object, it will walk towards it if you click on something. So I know that part of it is possible. It's basically just, these would be little macros that would be created, essentially. Once you're interacting with an object, then, it might start a conversation, and if that conversation starts, if the object is a person that you're interacting with, then we would just need the conversation options read aloud to us, as we select them. Now, this part would be a little bit more complicated only because we would need to factor in Telltale's tendency to have time limits on things. And the fact that screen reader speech is alterable. You know, the fact that you can have the speech rate at very low, very slow, or you could have it very fast. So we would need to probably eliminate the time limits or at least provide a much longer ultimate time limit to choose an option to get these options read. And that would cover almost everything in a Telltale game. Almost everything. That would just immediately accessibility done. Except for QuickTime events. And there is this QuickTime events brings up a different kind of point. When people think of making games accessible to blind people, some of them, not all of them, but some of them, think that what we need to get through a game is hashtag easy mode. That we will be happy if we just get through the game, and it's just really easy. And I'm not saying that that's a terrible option, because I think that the more options you have, the more gamers you can cater to. Maybe there are some gamers that just aren't comfortable enough yet with gaming to do a mode that is challenging. So you give them an easy mode. Okay, fine. But if you have the option there, that's the thing. Options are essential. So what I'm getting at with this is it has been suggested that to make a game accessible to blind people, we should remove all QuickTime events. I don't like that suggestion, personally. I think instead of removing them, you should instead make them accessible in some way. QuickTime events have their place. Some games live on QuickTime events. Some games live on doing awesome things in QuickTime events. And I would, you know, as a gamer, I would love to be, I would love to have accomplished a successful QuickTime event that does something amazing like that, because it gives you that thrill of, yes, I did this thing, rather than it was just a cutscene. And so my suggestion here is to provide either a sound that is associated with a button press, or provide an actual, little tiny bit of voice recording that literally says the button's name when a QuickTime event happens. If you have to press circle, it says circle. If you press X, it says X. If you press Y, A, whatever it is. It's just, little bit of voiceover work. Or you can even have, on Xbox, you would have narrator say those things. So things like that. Little things that just make QuickTime events possible and accessible would be enough, in my opinion. But if you do that, we've made a difficult to get through Telltale game completely accessible with all of those things. And that's it. That's all you have to do to those games. Now, I believe that any game can be made accessible, including giant open world games. I've thought about these too. So again, it comes down to information. And sometimes it comes down to, sometimes you have to go with workarounds. And I think with giant open world games, you probably have to go with a few workarounds. So in a large open world game, you'd have to find a way to allow for navigation that both can get you to your objective, but also can allow you to wander and explore if you like. My idea with this is to have I did say this was going to be complicated. This one is a complicated one. To have a different version of whatever map your game uses that is browsable, even if it's like a giant menu of map items that you browse through, it'd be cool if it was a map that you could move around and hear different points on it as you hit them. But either way, I think we would accept. If you select a point on that map, then that point would become a waypoint. And then we could either press a key or have a constant reminder. I personally would prefer pressing a key instead of having a constant tone in your ear. And that would give us a sound cue that would maybe point us in the direction of that waypoint. Kind of like the way the Resident Evil moves us, but not automatic like that. So we still have the freedom of movement ourselves, and we can actually do it ourselves. And then along the way, if there's something that might divert us from that path, like if there's some hint that there might be some treasure nearby or something like that, have a little sound cue play that says, hey, there's an item over there. You should probably go pick that up, or at least consider it. Then we could leave that waypoint active, or it doesn't have to be an item you can pick up. It could be any interactable thing. Maybe we could leave that waypoint behind for a second and go instead locate that thing and then come back to that waypoint and then proceed towards our objective. These are just, you know, simple ideas. These are overarching ideas. These aren't for any particular game. These are just, you know, general ideas. You know, just things like that. Navigation, combat, you could have a little bit of, you know, perhaps a little bit of assistance with aiming if it's, you know, gun-based, or just kind of general assistance with targeting. I've had some ideas too about accessibility with targeting when it comes to you know, maybe moving a reticle with a thumbstick, but having an audio cue when you're either aimed correctly or when you're almost aimed correctly. If you have a tone that plays when you're aiming, and the pitch increases as your aim, you know, gets closer and closer to a potential target, you know, that's one way to do it. There's so many ways to approach these things. But ultimately what I'm saying is it's all about information. Sound cues are tremendous. And there are some things that developers would have to get past to really truly implement this well. And that is the idea that things that don't make sound naturally would need to make sound for us to be able to use and appreciate them. The problem with Resident Evil 6 right now is, and it's not going to be updated anymore, so it's going to always be a problem. The problem is we can play the game, but you would not believe how many crates and just random... that was awesome. How many crates and interesting little ammo drops that are... Look, Cortana, I do not appreciate your interference. I will be contacting Master Chief immediately and filing a report. All right. So, but you would be amazed at how many crates and how many little ammo drops and healing herb drops that we just miss. Why? Because they're not on the direct objective path. Remember, we're being moved automatically to our objective here by holding down a button and, you know, walking. It's always going to point directly at the objective. It's not going to do anything else. So there's so many things we miss. But we wouldn't miss those things if those things, as ambient as they are not, you know, the little crates you can smash and little things you can pick up, they wouldn't make sounds while they're laying there on the floor normally. But if we had those sound cues, if they did make a little bit of sound to let us know that, hey, we are here, and again, with good audio design, all we would need is the sound in, you know, placed at its actual location so we could use directional audio to navigate to it. With good audio design, we could find it, and we could pick it up, or if it's a crate, utterly destroy it. And that's again, that goes back to the theme that I'm approaching here: information. That is all we need. We need information. When you play a game, close your eyes and consider what information you're missing. Keep trying to play the game. Good luck. You know, because you're not going to have the knowledge of all the workarounds we have. But that's kind of the goal. Like, a lot of people will say that closing your eyes is not enough to emulate a blind person, and it's not. That's true. But it is good, I think, for video games, because if you don't have the knowledge of the workarounds that we already have, we shouldn't, ideally, in a perfect world, we wouldn't have to have those workarounds anyway. So without any knowledge, you know, close your eyes, play a game, see how you do. Consider what information is missing, and how that information could be provided to a totally blind person via sound cues, via vibration cues. Madden was brought up earlier as a game we can play completely blind. Madden is a good example, but it doesn't really use audio cues, except for the ones that are already in the game. For instance, the commentary of Madden is very helpful, because there's a lot of it. But Madden primarily uses tactile feedback. It uses vibration for a lot of its cues. For instance, the kick meter is not presented by an audio cue, although personally I think it should be, but it's not. It's presented by a series of vibrations when the meter hits certain points. When the meter hits the top of its power level, you get a little vibration in your controller to indicate that just happened. That system works, don't get me wrong. I'm not hating on that system. That is a viable and useful system, and I have Madden gameplay on my YouTube channel because of that, because of the way they did things, and that's fine. But the reason I say it should have been an audio cue is so we could better gauge before the meter hits the top of the power level. Because the problem is, if you miss that vibration by a millisecond, well, guess what? The meter's at the bottom again. So you kind of have to time it anyway. Now, it can help you, don't get me wrong, it can help you with learning that timing based on your difficulty level, because it decreases based on how difficult the game is. It can help you with that. But I really feel like it should have been an audio cue, like a rising tone, a rising pitch with a maximum height that it indicates when it's at its highest power level. Maybe that combined with vibration to help, you know, to help in both ways. But anyway, that's that. So that kind of covers my examples of accessibility, ways to make certain games accessible. And I want to say that I am a very, very passionate and open person. I'm very easy to get a hold of, and I want to help. Like this work, doing this right now, this is what I want to do. You know, I have another dream. I have a dream of being a professional voice actor, but that's another thing entirely. I'll work on that. But this is what I would really love to do for basically my entire life now, because I've become so involved in this and so passionate about it that I, you know, this is what I want to do. And that kind of brings me to my last real point of my talk here, is my idea of what my role is going forward with this. And what that is I've realized that I need to be an advocate and an educator, both. I have to be willing to be committed, and I have to be willing to be an open book, and, you know, talk to people about different aspects of this, and kind of think of ways that other people are seeing accessibility and work with them and work around that. And that's what I've vowed to do, is to be as educational as possible, be as easy to get a hold of and easy to contact as possible, be as open as possible, be as willing to discuss anything. If you have the weirdest question about accessibility, like, how do you, like, punch someone in a fighting game? That's fine. Ask it. I don't care. I will tell you. It's square. Oh, sorry. It's X. Xbox, right? No, but it doesn't matter, because every little thing is going to lead us to more accessibility. Now, believe it or not, I'm not done yet. I have one more thing that I want to mention. I'm going to talk about a blog that I wrote recently. And I wrote it thinking that, I wrote it with a lot of concern when I wrote it, because I was worried that people would take it the wrong way. I was worried that people would see it as me whining, when that's not the case. And I'll kind of explain as I talk about the blog post itself. Maybe some of you have read it. Maybe some of you already know what I'm talking about. I was shocked when I wrote it, because when I did and finally published it and let people know that I was concerned about the way it would be received, it was not received that way at all. And it got retweeted for days and reposted for days afterward. I think people are probably still reposting and retweeting it today. I don't know. So essentially what it was is, it's a blog about the pain of inaccessibility. And this is what I'm going to use to bring my point home to all of you. And I hope this is effective. I really do. All right. So I'm going to have to use a PS4 example here. Sorry about that. But here it goes. The blog I wrote started by me describing myself waiting until midnight for the little chime that indicated to me that a wonderful little game, at least I hope it's wonderful, called Detroit Become Human, unlocked, because I had pre-ordered it. And, you know, it unlocked at midnight on its release day. So there I was waiting for that chime, waiting for that to happen. But I already knew, that I couldn't play the game. I already knew that it wasn't accessible. I knew this because I knew already that it was in the same style as other games from that developer, who had made games like Heavy Rain, Indigo Prophecy, that kind of thing. It was mechanically, it was the same type of game. That already was an indicator that I couldn't play it. But the most obvious indicator that I couldn't play it was that I had tried the demo already. They'd released the demo beforehand, and I'd already tried it, and I already utterly failed at it. But I'll try anything once. So I tried it. I failed at it. I knew I couldn't play it. So then, why? That is the big question. Why did I wait? Why did I wait for it to unlock? Why did that matter to me at all? Because guess what? I love games. You know, even games I can't play, I love them. I love narrative-based games. I love games with great stories. I love games with great soundtracks and great voice acting and, you know, great sound design. Even if the sound design doesn't mean I can play it, I love games like that. I love games. And that's what it boils down to. It's not just this. It's not just the accessibility I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about games themselves. And so when that happened, when that chime finally rang, I experienced a combination of delight, absolute delight, because the game that I've been anticipating for 5 years had been released, and also frustration, because I knew that that didn't matter, because I still can't play it. I won't be able to play it. It's too complex a game to just patch in accessibility. It would have had to been, you know, thought of, you know, especially for blind people, it would have had to been thought of already. And so there I was, you know, just living that. And that happens a lot with big releases. I look forward to big releases as much as anyone. It doesn't matter what platform it is. It doesn't matter, you know, I love games. And I watch E3 every year. I want to go someday. But I watch E3 every year, you know, and I look forward to the huge announcements, the surprises, the unexpected sleeper hits of E3. And I can't play most of them, but I still look forward to it because I love games. And that's my point. And that's it's a point that I've made before, but it's a point that I think now that I've published it and now that it's received such a positive reaction, it's a point that I think that blog really makes well. And that's, I'm going to end my little talk here with just a basic reiteration of that point. It's a point I've made in talks before, but it comes down to one very simple thing. We blind gamers are out there. We are gamers, we're real, and we want to play your games too. And that's basically it. That's all I got.